So welcome to Adelaide Chronicles, David.
Thank you.
Adelaide Chronicles is a podcasting platform that is all about a sustainable, inclusive future and about people that in one way or another shape Adelaide. And it's always recorded, in most situations it's recorded on Kaurna land, and we acknowledge and respect the Kaurna people and the elders past, present and upcoming. We've got a fascinating topic today. Would you like to just introduce yourself and say who you are and what you do?
I'm Dr. David Faber. I'm a jobbing historian around town. I have a position at the Flinders University as an adjunct research fellow. I practice, my major historical project has been the life and times in the early 20th century of an Italian anarchist immigrant to Australia who was assassinated in the Loveday internment camp in November 1942. But I've also done a little colonial history, written a little article about the killing of an Aboriginal woman in 1829 in my home district in northwestern Tasmania, and I do a little local history around the precincts of the southwest of the city of Adelaide. I'm involved with the Historical Society and the Labour History Society. Essentially, I'm a Labour historian, which is to say a historian of the 99% of the working class, essentially.
There's a lot of stories there.
Yes. Well, the history is just an infinity of stories.
It's interesting that we're talking about this right now, perhaps we're just sort of emerging from the lockdown of the COVID-19. And it's proven to us that there's so many lessons that we should have learned and we haven't.
Yes, from the Spanish flu, for example. I mean, around the world, governments dithered for the first fortnight and let the horse out of the barn to their cost. If people had a greater awareness of history, they would have been working on preparing for a pandemic of some kind or other.
Exactly.
And some of that did go on in the United States, but then Trump stood down the Obama's committee, which was doing forward planning.
And there were people here in Australia who were involved internationally on looking at future pandemics. And again, funding was cut to that. But there's people that have said, and people that I've interviewed as well, that have said it was inevitable.
Well, you know, the world's very varied place, and in it there are microbes which are trying to make a living for themselves, and if they have to be out to get us to do it, they will. If we muck up, then we'll pay the cost.
Exactly. So as a historian, you're one of the people that could help to teach us to learn these lessons, or to at least highlight
it. But not from the position of an expert, from the position of a fellow student, a specialist student, but only a student nonetheless. There's an interesting story during the 17th century in England, when the British philosopher Hobbes, who was basically a scientist, who was practicing in an era of civil war, got interested in political philosophy. And he was involved in discussions about the status of the law at that time. And some people queried his right to have a say, and he said, well, there are no experts, we're all just students, and I'm a student of the law as much as you are, Mr. Lawyer.
I love that.
Yeah, great story.
It is a great story, and if we're not students, then we think we know it all.
Well, right from the time of Socrates, and philosophy has an intimate relationship with history. They grew up together in the shores of the Aegean 3 millennia ago. Socrates knew that the best position to start from was this fact, admission of your own ignorance.
Always learning and always discovering new things. And it's one of the things that I actually love about the relatively new science, neuroscience.
Yes.
It's exposing things that people thought were completely absolute about it. That this was the right way. And then neuroscience is finding out it's not necessarily. So tell us some of the things that you're working on.
Well, at the moment I'm working on a pamphlet about the brief political history of the Greens in South Australia. It's a 25th anniversary publication. And I'm looking at the political philosophy, the political experience, the factional history that all parties go through, that the Greens have gone through to arrive at their current orientation and practice. That one's front of mind at the moment because I want to get it produced by September at the latest.
And what's that for?
That's for the Greens AGM, but we're planning a launch in the Parliament House Library because I'm the first person to have written anything about the Greens in South Australia as a standalone publication. There have been other scholars who've, in the course of other studies, have made significant mention of the Greens in South Australia, but usually as one example of a national experience.
How did you get asked to do that?
Green, his wife got a job in Adelaide for 6 months at the university, so he came out for a sort of a sabbatical and looked up the Greens here, and I was sitting next to him at a branch meeting, and he asked about the history of the Greens here, and was there anything he could read, and I had to tell him no, and then he worked out that I was a historian, and he put the hard word on it to remedy the need. So then I went to Mark Parnell and said, asked if this was a useful exercise, and he thought it was, and I've just been collecting interviews and documents for the last 3 years. And now I'm in the writing up stage.
That's fantastic. And it's fabulous the way that it happened. It's really organic, isn't it?
Yes, well, history's an organic process, which is interested in organic processes.
Yes, yes. One of the things that we talked about before we started this recording was that the past is never dead. It's always with us.
And yes.
There's a quote from Faulkner, but I'm sort of paraphrasing that quote, but there was also a book that uses that quote that was written that talks about the destruction of that was caused in the 20th century.
Yes, you might be referring to Gabriel Kolko's Century of War, I think. Yes, it was... As Hobsbawm said, it was a century of extremes, the 20th century, and you've got improvements in the living conditions of some classes, of some peoples around the world, but you also had the most terrifying massacres and the most horrendous and intense wars.
And the capacity for mass killing?
Is infinite. There may be some limitations to it, but there's a hell of a lot of damage done before they reached. We can't afford to go on like that. We have to grow out of it somehow.
We do. And do we need a revolution to do that?
Yes, but that raises the question of what you mean by revolution. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's about throwing up the barricades anymore at our ex. It's not necessarily about violent insurrection. There may be moments of mass mobilisation and some of them may end up involving force, particularly if the powers that be that get challenged won't stand aside. they tend to resort to force, and that tends to bring a reaction. But, I mean, Gramsci, for example, the Italian Marxist political philosopher, had a very acute sense of history. Thought that the revolution was a cultural process.
I'd like to think that myself.
Yes, it could be peaceful. And Marx thought that it could be peaceful under a Westminster system, although he didn't expect the ruling class to stand aside meekly.
Can you envisage it?
Yes, I feel I'm part of it. I feel we're all part of it.
We're all part of this process.
History is a revolutionary process. There's always change.
There's no gradient to measure?
Oh, there might be a gradient. It's one way of looking at it. But revolution is associated with the notion of peak moments, you know, when events seem to move so much faster than they do in the ordinary years, when it feels like the Berlin Wall will never fall and so on.
So it does seem like the world's moving faster.
Yes, well, that's at a biological level, of course, it's always moving faster, because as we get older, each increment of time gets to be a lesser proportion of the time we've experienced. But yes, I think there is an acceleration going on towards some kinds of denouement whereby we will get the choice, as Marx predicted, between being free and having a peaceful, productive, creative society that ministers to human needs and caters to the planet, or we will reject all that, all those prospects and freedoms, and we will have a socio-economic and ecological crisis. And basically, I think those two processes are just different sides of the one coin. The opportunity and the risk are part of the same situation.
And the risk is huge now.
Risk is getting bigger all the time. And there are people playing brinkmanship. Mm. I mean, poking the Chinese dragon.
Mm.
It is absurd.
It is absurd.
It violates every rule of diplomacy and wisdom.
It can't end well.
No. Certainly not for Australia, because we're too small.
We're too small, yeah.
To be able to live with that sort of fallout.
So from your analysis of history and past revolutions, if you like, or movements, where do you see us now?
Well, I like to draw a comparison with the late 19th century, when the class conflict was extremely intense around the world and here in Australia. We had the Shearers strike, the Maritime strike, both defeated. Within 10 years, you had a Labor Party formed, which did the obscene thing of actually securing office for 3 months in the eyes of the ruling class at one stage. And then the next government they formed in a landslide in 1914. So although times are tough now, that doesn't mean that we don't have opportunities, and we don't have freedom. You know, free will, the freedom to act.
We being people who are not in extreme poverty, have more freedom in many ways now.
But yes.
The we that are in extreme poverty or minority groups.
Well, they're living in a state of necessity where they get up in the morning and they fight to live.
Mm.
If you've got a little bit of liberty of action, if your circumstances are moderately propitious, then yes, you're on a better wicket.
So moving on, it's the same topic, but it's a slightly different subject.
Mm.
One of the things I'm particularly interested in at the moment is the casualisation of the workforce.
Oh, yes.
And what that's...
Well, that's been a basically deliberate strategy to weaken the working class.
Mm.
Its ability to collectively bargain. And it's been going on for over a generation.
And people will take it because they need a job.
Yes, take it or leave it.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
And a lot of them are growing up culturally deprived of any awareness that things are ever any different, any better. But you know, I went through the university system on the Whitlam dispensation, which meant that I just invested my time and labour, which I was unstinting with. But the financial cost was borne by the taxpayer, which is the way I think it should be, because that way you get doctors and historians that you need when you need them. But many young people now, bright young people who could do well with, for example, an arts degree, are not doing it because they would have to incur a debt that would lock them out of housing for a lifetime.
And with so many people working casual, you can't get loans, you can't buy a house. There's so many things that you just can't do.
Yes.
Because there's never any guarantee that it'll be a steady income.
And, you know, back during the long boom, when there was a bit of a de facto social democratic consensus, which even the Liberals wisely signed on for, things were much better. People could own their own houses, you know. In the 70s and early 80s, you could get a free tertiary education. You can't now, and many young people would be surprised to hear that you ever could. Because, you know, the reality that we're experiencing can blinker our perception. You know, things that seem natural often are not.
Just the recent shocking death of a woman with cerebral palsy is an example of what can happen.
Yes, when systems break down totally.
When systems break down totally, and clearly it broke down totally in this instance, and there was no checks and balances to, and no accountability.
And there's been a deliberate running down of the social net, social safety net, so that people are bound to fall through the cracks, and the society of two-thirds who are doing all right just carry on regardless and leave a third of the society to rot, essentially.
So from your historian perspective, what do you think is the biggest lesson we could learn, say, from COVID-19?
Well, I think the biggest lesson to be learned is that the public sector has a role, and that as we emerge into the post-COVID recession that we're going to have, even the Prime Minister admitted today that it wasn't going to be what they call a V response. You know, we're not going to accelerate rapidly into renewed prosperity. The role of the state in dealing with the unemployment and the economic inefficiencies that are inherent in the capitalist system, particularly when it's on the down curve, need to be addressed, and this government doesn't want to address them. It prefers its old comfortable prejudices about not spending money, essentially, about austerity. When in fact what we need is more social justice, more state expenditure, and these lessons have to be learned. You know, otherwise we're going to go through another depression with the same government policies in place that were in place during the last depression, which made the depression worse.
And if you add climate change
Oh, absolutely.
To that, then it's catastrophic.
Well, the crisis is ecological and socioeconomic. My concern from a political point of view is that if you have a complex society and you have people locked into accepting that they are the drones of the system, they're not going to be able to lift their horizons enough to be able to deal with climate change, because essentially they're just forced to focus on putting bread on the table within the system, and they won't care about the environment or won't perceive the environment because they're not being looked after and they're not being encouraged to educate themselves and empower themselves and seize power, in effect. Because without that seizure of power, I don't think the double crisis is going to be dealt with. Though I remain an optimist that it can be dealt with.
It's a big bleed, isn't it?
Well, there's a Gramsci again had a slogan which he borrowed from a French novelist, which was pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. You know, see things for as bleak as they are, but then get up in the morning and do something about it. And there's this famous line from a Hunters and Collectors song. I cry for the future, but I never get anything done.
Not like that. Hunters and Collectors, okay. Yeah. Did you have any more you wanted to add?
No, I'll just wind up by saying that I think it's the historian's civic duty to be a bit of a shotgun rider as we go forward, and call out risks which study of the past has taught us need to be addressed going forward.
It's been fascinating, David.
Thank you.